on our newest exhibition, Dark Matters, and two of our newer curators, Mika Yoshitake and Melissa Ho, organized the exhibition. So we're excited. It's taking over from Color Forms, which was here for a long time, and we're taking a different look at the collection and focusing on all things dark, literal and figuratively. And there's quite a few new acquisitions in this show, too. So we're excited to have them talk about it today. Thanks.
Thanks, Jenny. And thank you, everybody, for joining us today. My name is Melissa Ho. This is Mika Yoshitake. As Jenny said, we're assistant curators here at the Hirshhorn. And do you see some familiar faces here? So many of you probably are already aware of the general organizational scheme of our galleries. But just to note that upstairs on the third gallery, we, of course, feature our permanent collection as well. But there, we have organized it more or less in roughly chronological and historical groupings, so that as you move through that ring, you get a sweep, you get at least one version of a story of art in the 20th century through today. On the lower level, we like to present the permanent collection in a different way. We have developed this recurring thematic, concentrated thematic exhibition. And as Jenny mentioned, the show that immediately preceded this one, organized by our colleague Evelyn Hankins, was Color Forms. And that explored color and abstract form. And we did talk about, as we were developing our ideas for this exhibition, how Dark Matters would be a very extreme contrast. Because here, we're wanting to explore all of the formal as well as metaphorical meanings and associations with darkness. So darkness, when we say something is dark, we generally mean it's gloomy, sinister, mysterious. People, human beings, seem to have a visceral, primal fear of the dark. I guess that's our ancestral memory of being prey animals. But there's also something potentially very peaceful and even transcendent about darkness. And here I'm thinking more of the experience of looking into the infinity of outer space, or perhaps the depths of the ocean. And for artists, darkness, or black, has repeatedly served as a way to reinvent and reassess one's artistic practice. And here I am thinking primarily of painters who have returned to a very reduced formal palette of black as a way of getting back to basics and sort of turning a new page and starting over in their art practice. You see that in mid-career for several painters in the 20th century. And so there is a sense, as much as we associate blackness often with mortality or bleakness, there is a sense of renewal or rebirth with blackness and darkness as well. And in this opening gallery, we wanted to start with two works that are instances of this. On my right here is a painting called Rundle Castle from 1959 by Frank Stella. And this is very much an instance of a very young artist. Stella was probably 1 or 2 years out of college at this point when he made this work. A young artist staking a new claim and saying, I want to open a new chapter and sort of kill my elders, metaphorically, because you have to remember that in the late 1950s, the ethos of spontaneous expression represented by artists like Bakunin's gestural abstract expressionism was really dominant. And what was really flooding the market was, of course, all of the imitators and followers of Bakunin. So Stella wants to eke out a new space, a new way of making painting. And so at that time, this would look very blank, very impersonal, empty to a lot of viewers. There's also a darkness here. This is part of a large group of 23 paintings that he made in 58 and 59 that became known as the Black Paintings. And there was a darkness deliberately built in with the titles of these works as well, because several of them refer to fascism, Nazi Germany, and several more refer to tenement buildings and other monuments of a bleak urban landscape, which was the one that Frank Stella, as a very young artist, just having moved to New York and making his way in the world, for the first time as an adult, was encountered as well. He was at this time, by 59 he was not, but in 58 he was working as a house painter for basically a slumlord real estate developer who hired him mostly to paint tenement buildings, and Arundel Castle is the name of one of those buildings. So facing Stella's black painting is this work from 1977 by the German artist Joseph Beuys, and its title is FIU Blackboards. FIU stands for Free International University, and Beuys, of course, is well known for having a deep belief in the idea that art could and should play a larger transformational role in society. And for Beuys, he's a teacher throughout his career, teaching, conversation, debate, discussion, these are all things that he defined as central to his art practice. And the FIU was an entity that he established in 1972, basically to encourage cross-disciplinary discussion and to sort of embed in the society the idea that people from all walks of life and all professions could operate with the same freedom and creativity that usually is reserved for artists. So this is actually sort of the physical development of action that Beuys mounted at Documenta in 1977. Documenta is a recurring international art exhibit, happens about every 5 years in Kassel, Germany. And at Documenta 7, he held a 100-day action, which basically was a series of workshops and seminars where he invited people. There were just, of course, passerbys and people who just were at the fair. And then there were speakers from all different professions, sciences, policy, history. And as he ran these workshops, he was continually writing and drawing and diagramming all these blackboards and washing it down and filling it and emptying it and filling it and emptying it and sort of continuous cycle. And at the end of Documenta, he took the rag and the water from the bucket and wiped it down the final time, leaving it blank and open for figuratively for us to continually So both of these works are sort of generative works that we wanted to open the show. Because we want to say a little bit about everything in the show, we're going to try to move through without questions at every stop, but I will figuratively hand the mic now to Mika.
Well, and our group grew a lot, so can you guys hear? Or just we can use the microphone if you can't hear. Okay. Originally, we only had a few people, so I didn't think it was worth it.
Okay, so let's move over to the second gallery here. So as Melissa was mentioning, this exhibition really brings together groups of artists from many different movements and generations, and the shift that really happens from the first gallery, where we really see this one of the primary artists of the modernist generation of painting, and also very emblematic of social sculpture, Joseph Beuys. There's a shift that happens from a very kind of engagement with abstraction into the return to images and to figuration. And so some of the selections of the works that you see here really kind of define in many different kind of contexts how the artists have rethought politically, conceptually, and within, primarily starting from the early 70s, onto the present moment. And a few of the artists that we've selected here are from the Pictures Generation, which was an exhibition that happened in 1977, but they're a combination of West Coast and East Coast artists, and this is a painting by Troy Brontok, and he is also someone who was graduated from CalArts in the 70s, and he was part of this group which really after the notions of minimalism and conceptual art, where there was this more engagement with perception and also formal aspects of painting, there was a resurgence of images in everyday life that, and he was, that this generation of artists really appropriating from magazines, television, advertisements. And Troy Bromtuck in particular was very interested in looking at fascist aesthetics in, and also in actually Nazi Germany, and looking at the kind of power that those systems or the kind of formal aesthetics of those images had in his moment. And we have to remember that in the 70s, it was really after the failure of the Vietnam War protests and the Watergate crisis, and it was a time of kind of post-political upheaval of the 60s, and where artists were really trying to understand what it means to paint, what it means to be an artist quite generally, and with this proliferation of different media. And so it was actually a pretty strong stance to go back to painting. And so this generation's picture, generations of artists really, they represent that return. And here we see, we weren't actually exactly, there's much literature on this specific work, which is actually a later piece, 1989. But it is, you know, obviously of a farmer who's about to kill his cow. And the characteristics that really define Bromtuck's work is that there is this kind of double experience of immersion and distance. He paints on this kind of very thick felt-like cloth. And so when you look up to it, you really see the image from a distance. But as you go up to it, there is this kind of fake blurry effect that you can't really, it's not as crystal clear. And so that effect is actually very, very strategic on this part. And so you have here, you know, there is this fire that's happening, there's this very, very tense like atmosphere in which this animal is about to get about to be killed. And so this painting was actually one of our
It was definitely linchpin work when we saw this. And this quality that Nika references of having to search a little bit, having to sort of grope for the subject matter, the oscillation between the image coming into resolution and falling out of resolution is something that recurs throughout the show. It's a formal and thematic device that is one of the ones associated with darkness that you see artists of different generations deploying, certainly with the Bromtuck, as well as the Gonzalez.
Well, so in relation to the Bromtuck, Gonzalez is actually a contemporary artist. He was born in 57 in New Orleans, and he actually studied painting at Peter Halley, and he did a whole series of works of JFK, and he actually grew up, his family was, actually there were some relations with the JFK assassination, so there was fascination with that idea of politics and power. And this painting, well, it's actually a silkscreen, a large scale, was done right around the time of the 9/11 attacks. And of course, this is a picture of the Pentagon. And the way in which he came up with this technique was that in 89, he saw a retrospective of Andy Warhol. It was very much influenced by the way in which silkscreens were actually made into paintings. And he was working with the earlier Photoshop and kind of reconfiguring the image in various tones, various four tones, and making that monochromatic so that you could see how the image could be represented from afar, but then close, when you go close to it, you can really become so blurred to the point where you can't see what the actual image is. And this was a metaphor for him in terms of what was happening at the time and the kind of lack of truth and clarity during the Bush administration of the terrorist attacks. And so there is that, again, with the montage, there is that relation between, you know, what you see and that kind of blurring or, you know, obstruction of what you're actually seeing. So I thought that these two, even though they are very different, went very well together. And then just moving on to this here. This is by Alan McCollum, called Surrogate. And Alan McCollum was also part of the West Coast, he was a little bit younger, but part of the West Coast Generation the Pictures group. And he is much more aligned, this work is much more about the kind of politics of the time. And basically he was trying to figure out, it wasn't really about the, you know, uniqueness of a work or the repetition in which you see this minimalism and the kind of seriality here that is happening, but really thinking about how only the context within which a work is within which a painting is presented, and the kind of overlooked aspects of how we kind of frame perceive and look at art. And he was also interested in the kind of contractual relation between the artist and the collector, and the fact that, you know, there is this kind of accumulation of value that happens when a collector begins to collect artwork and paintings, and yet there, within that kind of desire to accumulate, it is feeding that kind of emptiness by producing these images that obviously have a very within them blank, void, black images, and so they are actually nothing, but in effect they are symbols of what you would think of as a relation of a collection. And so, I mean, there's so much literature on McCollum. Theoretical theorists and you know, academics love his work because it's not just about he utilizes the sign as a way to kind of think about systems of commodity culture and also the exchange of capital that happens. And this was produced, he began these series in 1978, but really, these plaster, these are all made out of plaster, and these plaster surrogates really came into kind of international recognition in the 80s. And of course, the 80s were a time of, you know, very the height of the capitalist economy in the United States. And so, in a sense, this is, when I say the return to images, it is, of course, an annihilation of an image, but that annihilation is a comment on the way in which we perceive images, and even as a void. And then finally here,
we brought back Big Man.
We brought back Big Man, which I've heard it's one of the most popular pieces in our collection. This is a sculpture by Ron Muick. And he is, Ron Muick was an artist who is probably most well known for being a part of the Sensations Young British Artists exhibition, which happened in 1997. Some of his contemporaries are Matthew Barney and Dino Sin, Jack Chapman, and so basically in the late 90s, there was this kind of shift towards thinking about a hyper kind of
realism. And when you think of the kind of hyper-artificial representations of abstraction, I think that you can think about the artificial representations of realism as well. I mean, he worked originally as a model maker for television and film, and so that's how he began creating these sculptures of silicon and fiberglass, and to a very, very fine-tuned precision replication of the human body, mostly nude. And usually all of his sculptures are of a slightly exaggerated scale. So the one that was in the Sensations show was of his father. It's called Dead Dad. And it was an actual corpse of a shriveled, stiffened corpse of his father who had just died at the time. And I think that the kind of visceral and psychological impact that this kind of hyperrealist sculpture has is very, very dynamic and also shocking to many of the viewers at the time.
And Dead Dad was a little bit longer scale, right?
Yes, that was small.
Because yeah, all of his work is either a little bit too big or a little bit too small. And that's part of its uncanniness, because it's hyper-realistic and so convincing in its figuration, but it's also off. It's also totally wrong.
Right. And that offness is usually the kind of grotesque, you know, psychological effect that it has on the viewer. That's why it's so popular, is because people are just tempted to look at why this is, you know, you think that it is an imitation of reality, but it's actually, you know, that weirdness, that grotesqueness is what we are all trying to search for. And, you know, when I saw this at the storage space, I was just blown away. I mean,
we kept questioning ourselves, can we really put this in a show called Darkness? Are people going to just not accept it, you know, because it's not literally dark? But we exactly, for a show like this, is an opportunity to make linkages, connections between works of art of all different media. So, you know, in this gallery alone, we have late 19th century photography, exemplified by the work by Thomas Higgins, that wasn't made as a work of art, it was made as an anatomical study. We have Muex, like hyper-realistic, figurative sculpture, and we have the image, you know, Rontok and Gonzalez, and then McCollum, which is this funny play on mass production, but in this handmade form, that both seem, you know, what it's saying about work of art and the painting is its contributions of the theme of darkness, blankness. And that's something that we can do in these shows down here that's a little bit different from what we do upstairs.
Right.
Do you want to talk about cultural next, or?
Sure.
I don't think we can go into, there's a video piece in this next exhibit, but we can't fit in there as a group. So I don't know, it just makes sense to talk about it, maybe later they can. But then that's...
We won't
talk about it. Maybe we'll let them...
Yeah. Or you can give a brief introduction to it at the end if you want.
Yeah.
Okay. That way.
Right. Okay.
So let's talk about the last one. Thames as in the Thames River in London. It was made in 1999-2000. She was commissioned to do a work. A lot of her work has actually gone back to the motif of water. She was commissioned to do this work focusing on the Thames. And as she described it in some statements, this was a very low, melancholic moment in her life. She had just ended a relationship. She was feeling very down. And as she spent weeks researching and contemplating this river, that seemed to only mirror back to her her own emotions at that time, she learned that the Thames is a very dangerous, fast-moving body of water. It's a tidal river. So it can really pull you under. And a lot of people drown by accident, and it also attracts a lot of suicides. It also apparently is a good spot to dump a dead body. She learned all this through a series of interviews with different people who worked on the river, from police to boatsmen. And she described this work as a vicarious suicide, as kind of mirroring her very low state of mind at that time. She took the photographs from a scaffolding that she built on a tugboat and sort of traveled along the river, finding different lighting conditions, different spots of the water. And so it's all one continuous body of water, but of course it's an incredible array of moods and colors and instances within the series. And actually, our four photographs are just one grouping within a much larger body of photographs from the same series. All of these photographs are these views of the surface of the water that doesn't allow you to sort of penetrate further below. It also doesn't give you the vantage point of a shoreline or any kind of horizon. And one of the things that I find, what it's maybe in a way a similar sensation to confronting the hyperrealism at the same time unreality of something like Munich, she's given us a view of the river that we could never see in real life because she's stilling those waters. Of course, when you're actually on the riverbank looking at the surface of the water, you would never capture a view like this in the moment. So there's something emotionally interesting, I think, about that freezing of the moment. Next to Ronnie Moore are two photographs from 1981 by James Welling. James Welling is an artist who lives in Los Angeles. He's part of the so-called pictures generation that Mika mentioned earlier. And his photography straddles this interesting line between abstraction and representational works. This is part of, again, like the horns, part of a larger series of drapery photographs that he's made over the years. These dark ones in particular, from a distance, are very hard to discern what they are of. And then as you move closer and sort of allow yourself to be absorbed into that dim image, it's almost like the subject of the work becomes your conscious search for an image, a search for meaning. It makes you very... it makes that transaction much more close to the surface. Whereas normally with a photograph, we're accustomed to the idea the photograph is going to offer up its subject matter. There's an object that has been captured. Here, it's more of an image that absolutely is a straight image, but it offers up ambiguity. It offers up enigma. More than just plain information. This photograph is a man part of the series at various Civil War battlefields. Selling Man is an artist who lives in Virginia and is a lifelong Southerner. And this was a series she did in 2000 where she traveled to various battlefield sites and took pictures with a large format camera, which she does in other areas of her work as well. In this case, she used an obsolete Civil War era, 19th century technique of wet collodion plate, is what it's called, and it's essentially having to make
handmade film on the surface of a piece of glass. So it's very cumbersome. It's also extremely time sensitive because you have to expose that film and develop it while it's still wet. So you can imagine, she's working in this field with a large format camera with a, you know, essentially having to construct a darkroom in the field, coating the plate, exposing it and developing it all before that coating dries. Which is one of the reasons why this is not used that often anymore. But it would have been very familiar to photographers such as Gardner who were documenting the Civil War. So it's a reference to the period. But she's also using it in a sort of unconventional way because Colonial plate photographs are often beautifully crisp and clear. But Mann here has very deliberately coated the plate unevenly and allowed various scratches and scars and marrings to occur on that film, really making it seem like a metaphor for the bloodshed that that landscape has absorbed. And she has talked about how when she made this and other related pictures, she would lie down. It's this very low, you can see it's this very low vantage point up at this horizon, this empty, vacated landscape with just a glimmer of light breaking over the horizon line. But she would lie in the landscape and think about the thousands of people for whom that landscape was the last view they had of this world. And how they were absorbed into that land. There certainly is a morbid streak in some of Mann's work. She's also done a series of photographs of decomposing bodies. And she did a beautiful series of the dead body of her greyhound. So that's Sally Mann. Jack Goldstein, this is not a photograph, this is actually a painting. Jack Goldstein is also part of that pictures generation that we mentioned earlier. One of the things that characterizes some of their work is this use of found imagery from mass media. And Jack Goldstein is a very interesting artist, a conceptual artist who worked in a lot of different modes. He's actually probably most well known for his films, but he does have a smaller body of work in paintings, and they're all made from stock photos of war pictures, which an example of this, of a military plane flying, and also others are of natural phenomena like lightning or eclipses or solar flares. This is from 81?
Yeah, 81.
And which is early for his paintings. He started out painting them, but from what I understand, fairly quickly handed that task over to others, which is also how he made his films. They're all generated from stock footage.
There's a cue to the way, because he was working in films, the reason why these two black, it is framed by these side frames is kind of the way in which it's sort of like strip.
The sprockets of
The sprockets of So
it's also interesting that they're behind glass, they're glazed. But that's not the museum's choice, that's part of the work, so there's a distancing there too.
Right.
It's probably he's not foregrounding the handmade personal nature of the painting. He's putting it behind this very awesome material because he evened it all out and make it very easy. And then finally, this is a work by a husband and wife collaborative team, Bradley Vitale and Jacqueline Terry. Like the Sally Mann, really referencing a very dark period of American history. In this case, this is an image of Emilio Boynton in the center, who was a civil rights, one of the organizers of the marches from Selma to Montgomery in 1965. And it's based, like some other works we've looked at, on not found images, a photojournalistic image from a newspaper of. This is the first march that became known as Bloody Sunday because as the marchers tried to leave Selma to embark to Montgomery, they were stopped at the bridge that leaves the city and beaten and tear gassed by the police. And so that's the image that we see here. And McCallum and Terry are presenting it in this double form. So the surface closest to us is a tinted piece of silk that suspends the image in front of a twin image of the same photograph that's been hand painted. And if you look very carefully, there are areas of disconnect because they deliberately have altered or omitted details from the painted version behind. For them, this is very much a metaphor about how memory works. It's part of a larger series of civil rights images that they painted that they called whitewash. So they're clearly referring here to the annihilation of our collective memory of this history. It's kind of a human condition of how memory works. The further you get away from something, the less vivid it is, the less sure we are of the details. And I think they're trying to make us more alert to that, and as well as rejuvenate these images, make them live again in another form. And this is a quite recent work. It's from 2008. And this work, The Wellings, which is also a recent acquisition for us, and The Calderon, which is in the video gallery, it's exciting because we've never shown them here before. And so this is an opportunity to bring works to the public that we haven't been able to exhibit before. The Calderon, should we say something before or after? Or maybe we should take questions. Are there any questions about what we've looked at so far?
Just so you have brochures to hand out to visitors on this exhibit.
There's no publication for this exhibit. I also mentioned that it's going to be a fairly long installation. We're going to rotate some of the works. Some photographs, we have to worry about exposure. There's a limit to how long they can be shown under lights. And so certain works are going to rotate probably this summer. And then it'll be up maybe through next fall. So. You can hear the piece.
I think I might see the piece and then I can...
Hard to see it.
Okay.
I will say nothing other than I required that there be a parental warning. Not because because I have a young child myself and I thought, I think I'd want to know just because it's a little scary. But please, we're happy to talk to people more one-on-one, or if you want to look at the cauldron and come back. But thank you.